This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Kenneth Goldsmith is interested in the mundane, even the boring. He teaches a class at the University of Pennsylvania called Uncreative Writing, where students retype phone books and are not allowed to be original. He had a radio show that broadcast hours of silence except for the station ID. Soliloquy is a record of every word he spoke over the course of a week. Fidget is about his body movements over a 13-hour period on Bloomsday in 1997. Goldsmith transcribed radio and TV broadcasts of national tragedies, including the assassination of JFK, the World Trade Center attack on September 11th, the death of John Lennon for his latest book. It's called Seven American Deaths and Disasters. He was interested in what happened to language when hosts were forced off script as they searched for the words in real time to describe unfolding, terrifying, and heartbreaking news. And Kenneth Goldsmith joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Great to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here in Philly.
And Philly, indeed. Your book is about these, I guess, watershed events. Are these all events that you have lived through, and is that part of your interest in them?
Well, yeah. It renders the objective news events autobiographical. Yeah, these span my lifetime. I mean, I wasn't old enough to remember the assassination of JFK. I was a year and a half.
Right.
However, you know, it shapes my consciousness. JFK assassination is really the first media spectacle. You know, Marilyn Monroe dies. We don't have the media around it the way that we did with JFK. And it begins, something changes, something shifts in the way that we perceive public events. And the book takes its title from Andy Warhol's series of paintings, Deaths and Disasters. And Warhol made this beautiful, iconic portrait of Jackie Kennedy mourning. And you could say that Kennedy was aware of the cameras on her. She was staging her own role in a hyper-real film. And Warhol picked up on that. So you get this kind of refractive quality beginning with JFK and then playing out moving forward.
Well, what's interesting, even going through your book, these are transcriptions and collages. So they aren't, and it's interesting because when you listen to an actual broadcast and read some of your transcriptions in your book, they don't necessarily line up. I mean, there is some either liberty or something subjective or something about what we remember or what we don't remember about a particular event.
Well, I think transcription is subjective. You know, we tend to think of it as being cold and objective.
Right. And it's word for word,
not,
right?
Absolutely not. I do a exercise with students in a class where I have them transcribe something very dull, something like an NPR piece about a budget tax budget battle in Congress.
Touché.
Something that they won't get interested in.
Right.
And I ask 15 people to transcribe the identical radio clip, and they come back with 15 very different pieces of writing, you know, and which is correct. You know, they're all correct.
Like Rashomon, right?
Like Rashomon, exactly. And, you know, it's, you know, I think we try as writers too hard to express ourselves. Everything we do expresses our subjectivity. So I recommend a lighter touch in backing off. Right.
But, I mean, do you think of these, and I do want to play a clip from the JFK assassination, but do you find the mundane really mundane, or do you find it fascinating?
The mundane is extraordinary. The mundane is more exciting than any kind of fiction we could conjure.
You believe that?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I mean, reality TV has sort of proven me right on that, you know. I mean, it's so much
but
better than anything.
But reality TV is so fake.
Well, I mean, it's boring with all the boring parts taken out of it. And it's edited. I don't think it's fake.
Right.
I think it's edited. And it's, you know, just like this book. It's edited for the maximal impact.
Well, I do want to play a clip, and obviously for all the obvious reasons with the assassination of the 50th anniversary of the assassination of JFK, and I think we're used to by now the Walter Cronkite broadcast. I can see it. I can hear the pauses in his voice. I see him taking off his glasses. You chose something else from a Dallas radio station, KLIF. How come?
Well, I mean, this book is about the unfolding of tragedies in real time. What are the words we use to describe that which we never thought we'd have to describe? Cronkite, it was already digested by the time it came to him, and he was, you know, channeling all sorts. It was very sealed up. This is pretty raw stuff. This is people trying to figure out what is going on in their backyard as Kennedy's getting shot. It's the equivalent, the audio equivalent of the Zapruder film.
Oh, interesting. And this is a Dallas radio station, and I should say to our listeners, it begins with an ad, like one would hear on a commercial radio station. Let's listen.
For pimples and bad complexion, Baker's Beauty Lotion is the best yet. It's a new formula containing no harmful ingredients, plus easy, safe to use. Those who use Baker's Beauty Lotion face the world with a clear face or money back.
And now another report from Joe Long, downtown Dallas.
Latest details on the chase and search in downtown Dallas. An unidentified man fired several shots from what apparently was a high-powered 30-caliber rifle at the presidential motorcade. So far, the authorities are not releasing details on who, if anyone, was hit by any of the bullets or how badly they were injured. Parkland Hospital being very closed-mouthed about the situation, but the search now centers at the area of Elm and Houston near the old Texas School Book Depository building, and there is a possibility that the would-be assassin is still inside that building. All available downtown units are converging at emergency speed to that area. The entire area has been blocked off. It is roped off now. No one allowed in or out as the search for this would-be presidential assassin continues in downtown Dallas.
And that's from a Dallas radio station broadcast, KLIF, November 22nd, 1963. And what's so jarring, but I guess it's what you're interested in, is we begin with an ad for pimples or getting rid of pimples, and then this news broadcast of the president being shot.
Yeah, you can't isolate tragedy. You know, I mean, you know, there's a section here on 9/11, and you know, I remember coming up out of the subway and people are standing there thinking that it was a commuter plane that had, you know, some guy had a heart attack and flew into the building. We had no idea. So life went on around it and suddenly it became life itself.
But are you interested in what happens to the kind of scripted language? I mean, we all wake up thinking our day is going to go as we expect. And then, of course, things can and often do happen. Is that what you're interested in when somehow something surprising, maybe tragic, maybe wonderful happens and throws us off our script?
I'm not interested in the wonderful. I'm interested in the tragic. You know, the wonderful, we have the language to describe the wonderful. The tragic, we have to grapple for. What is it? And there's a lot of falsehood, a lot of truth, a lot of prejudice. You know, all sorts of things that we normally would hold back in our normative role as a radio host or television host. Suddenly, the inside and the interior, interiority, is revealed.
Well, and I've seen and heard people, broadcasters, hosts, cry on the air. I mean, there are those moments where you feel like that person leaks through.
It does, and I think part of being a successful radio personality is letting some of that leak through, but not too much. And it's, you know, it's pretty,
you know, Barbara Walters, right?
you're in control of the faucet. You can turn it on a little bit and it's very good. It makes you connect with listeners. This is kind of, you know, the faucet is broken and it is gushing and the language is, you know, is really very raw, something we don't get on media.
Well, that's interesting. And I have to say, even listening to some of these broadcasts, and we're going to play some more, and reading through your books, through your book here, what I do see and hear are broadcasters who are doing a pretty darn good job. There isn't a lot of hemming and hawing. They are trying to be descriptive. They're trying to stay as close to the truth as they understand it at the time. And I was surprised at how, and we even heard that in this particular broadcast, how clear that broadcaster was.
Well, I mean, radio sounded very differently 50 years ago than it does today. You know, today, I mean, you know, the Michael Jackson piece in here, which is the last one, The Death of Michael Jackson, you know, starts off with a sort of an afternoon zoo show where there's a lot of racism. There's a lot of us, you know, it's really, really, really rather nasty, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, and then back in the 60s, you really couldn't enter that subjectivity. And yet the fabric gets ripped in the Kennedy piece. They say, you know, this slips. A guy slips up and says, the president is dead. I'm sorry, wait a minute, let me rephrase that. We cannot tell you the president is dead until we get the official word that the president is dead. So there are these gentle tears in the audio fabric, whereas by 2009, it's just a, you know, pile on the child rapist. I mean, it's really, you know, so it's a different thing that happens.
But a radio zoo show is very different. I mean, they probably didn't have them back in the 1960s, or they operated in a pretty strong straitjacket. But those are two different worlds, it seems to me.
Yeah, but that is, you know, typical radio today. You know, is zoo, and we hear our tragedy through zoo shows, and you know, we have to listen to that language. We're forced to listen to it. It's around us. There's more of that than there is straight reportage. Though I did temper the Jackson piece with NPR Report, which was very sober and very straight and very rational. Mm-hmm. But then it gets a little bit wacky when they talk to their expert on Michael Jackson. So, you know, even when it's tamped down like what you guys do, within a certain range, it kind of gets weird. And, you know, it's a lot of unconsciousness, no matter how much control, illusion of control, right, you think you have.
Well, I had to laugh because we know that expert very well. It's Bob Thompson. And often if there is a cultural issue, he's someone at Syracuse that we call
Bob Thompson from Syracuse University.
You know,
he says the most ridiculous things about Michael Jackson. I mean, it's hysterical. I mean, the NPR guy is pretty straight, but this guy Thompson was really, you know, comparing
this
to...
But he's one of our go-to guests.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's, you know, he's colorful. He says, this is a Greek-like tragedy. And we listen and we say, Michael Jackson was great. But when you isolate those words, you go, really? Mm. You're comparing this to Homer? Really? Mm. This is interesting.
It is interesting. Is this poetry? You're a poet. Mm. Is this poetry?
It's what poetry sort of looks like now. I mean, poetry doesn't really look the way that... you know, that we once thought it did. Poetry is sort of, as a phrase, poetry has left the building. Elvis has left the building. Poetry has left the building. And it's gone out onto the internet, and it doesn't resemble, you know, anything that we know poetry to look like. Of course, the other type of New Yorker-style poetry continues on just fine. But the most innovative stuff is really data mining now and presenting itself as poetry, transcription, appropriation. All the visual art techniques are now being thrown at poetry and literature, and it's actually giving it a brand new life.
Hmm. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Kenneth Goldsmith is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. His latest book is called Seven American Deaths and Disasters. It includes transcriptions, collages of live broadcasts of memorable public tragedies. We have been, and we will continue to play a couple of clips as well, and talk more with our guest about boringness and dumbness and mundanity. Is that a word? I'm not even sure.
Mundaneness.
And you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
What can you do when roots or giant plants invade your compost pile? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll engage in a battle for your black gold. Plus, making new plants from old by simple layering. And answers to all your growing questions. At You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Do you recall the first time you met John Kennedy?
Yes, I do.
I told him, I said, Mr. Kennedy, he says, look, my name is Jack. You call me Jack.
And there he was, the President of the United States, standing on the doorstep.
I'm Robert McNeil, and the program is We Knew JFK, Unheard Stories from the Kennedy Archives, from the Public Radio Exchange.
God, I hope they don't play this for a long, long time.
Tomorrow night at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, we'll speak with actor and former SNL comedian Will Forte about landing his surprisingly serious role in the new film Nebraska.
I heard I got the job, and it was such a surprise. And that's when the terror settled in.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Kenneth Goldsmith. He teaches writing at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a senior editor of the online poetry archive Penn Sound, the first MoMA poet laureate, the founding editor of Ubu Web, and led a poetry workshop recently at the White House. And we have been talking about some of the ideas in his latest book called Seven American Deaths and Disasters. And this is another very tragic event, the murder, the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And you include in your book, and we're going to play an excerpt of Andrew West of KRKD. This is a Mutual News affiliate in Los Angeles. He's reporting from the Ambassador Hotel. This is June 5th, 1968. Let's listen to this clip, and then we can talk.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible?
No!
Is that possible?
No!
It could be.
Get out! Get out!
Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen? It is possible. He has. Not only Senator Kennedy. Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot. And another man, a Kennedy campaign manager, and possibly shot in the head. I am right here. Rafer Johnson has a hold of a man who apparently has fired the shot. He has fired the shot. He still has the gun. The gun is pointed at me right at this moment. I hope they can get the gun out of his hand. Be very careful. Get the gun. Get the gun.
Get the gun.
Stay away from the gun.
Get the gun.
Stay away from the gun. His hand is frozen. Get his thumb. Get his thumb. Get his thumb.
Get his thumb.
Take a hold of his thumb and break it if you have to. Get his thumb. Now, look. Get away from the barrel. Get away from the barrel, man.
Watch out for the gun. Watch the gun.
Look out for the gun. Okay. All right. That's it, Rafer. Get it. Get the gun, Rafer. Okay, now hold on to the guy. Hold on to him. Hold on to him, ladies and gentlemen. They have the gun away from the man. In this shot. They've got the gun. I can't see the man. I can't see who it is. But Senator Kennedy right now is on the ground. He has been shot. What is he? Wait a minute. Hold him. We don't want another Oswald. Hold him, Rafer. We don't want another Oswald.
Oh, that is just so chilling. I hadn't heard that in so many years. And first of all, we know what's going on there. But to hear his almost like word to moment by moment description about get the gun, get the gun, get the gun. It's terrifying.
Well, it's beautiful. It's beautiful language. And on the page, it's more like Gertrude Stein than anything else. And you see that our language, that Stein was right, that our language is repetitious. Mm. It's very simple. We keep saying the same thing over and over again, in the most direct and simple way possible. It's very beautiful. It's kind of the revenge of modernism. Everybody thought, no, that stuff is irrelevant, but in fact, it's more relevant than we know.
But this is murder too. I mean, someone was just murdered.
Someone was just murdered, and this is the words that Andrew West used to describe it. You know, and it's remarkable. You know, really, can you write anything better than that? I can't.
Well, I certainly can't as well. And it feels sort of weird to talk about the right what someone says when they are describing, you know, the murder of somebody. It's you know, to reference even Gertrude Stein, it's off-putting because this is real.
It's not real. It's not real. It's media. It's not real. Media is not real. Media is mediated. Mm. So that's you know, he's describing something, and then there's the historical displacement. There's the objectification of that language, and you know, I think it's open for scrutiny, you know, at an arm's length in a way that we can't possibly do it when it's unfolding. But the odd thing is that people said after reading this book that they heard the Boston Marathon Massacre very differently in real time. You know, the words become objectified, concretized, solidified. And suddenly it becomes, you know, language has several, works on several planes.
Well, is that why you're interested in, as you said, in tragedy and disaster? Because it puts us into this heightened sense of awareness?
I'm a boring writer. I spent 20 years doing the really books that were so dull I couldn't read them myself. I hate the books I write. I got bored of being bored, finally, after, one could go and retype the entire internet.
Which you almost have done, haven't you?
I've printed the whole internet. That's another show.
That's a whole other thing, right?
And then I decided what would happen if I used my same technique, which is just simply retyping things, transcribing things, and instead of, you know, putting my lens on things that were mundane and dull, what if I just turn the lens on something that was hot and extraordinary? Without doing anything different, I get a completely different effect. Now I'm in my mannerist and Baroque period of my work, but yet I'm not doing anything different than I did when I was, you know, transcribing traffic reports, really.
Which you did.
Yeah, of course I did. I read those at the White House.
Well, I know, and I read about you reading them at the White House, and what I found interesting was, at least I think this was your description, was when you were reading, you know, recognized poets.
Yeah, Whitman and Hart Crane.
And people paid attention, and they were interested in the words and probably how you were reading it. But when you were reading traffic reports, they really paid attention.
Yeah, the room popped. You know, they politely sat through the real poetry.
Right.
But when the most radical appropriation, thievery, you know, all the type of work that I do, enters the room, everybody paid attention. Now, it's traffic reports. They can't really understand Hart Crane, you know, Democratic bigwig fundraisers and mayors and, right, you know, senators, you know, can't possibly understand that. But everybody understands traffic reports. And it is the recognition of the vernacular that is comforting. And yet it's also a recognition of the most radical move that one could do, the most uncreative move that actually elicited the most emotion. So I kind of think of it as like radical populism that it's real hard to get that kind of response.
Were you surprised by that response?
No, because when I read things that I am uncreatively writing, I often find people in tears, you know, either through recognition, there's memories. Sometimes if I'll read the traffic report book in California,
right,
a few displaced New Yorkers will always come up to me and say, oh, it reminds me of sitting in my car on the Brooklyn Queens Expressway with my father when I was seven. This brings back all sorts of memories. Traffic reports can elicit great emotion.
And of course, so much a part of radio, right?
It's a beautiful sound. You know, I grew up in New York. It's the sound of New York. 1010 Winds, you know.
Right. Dun, 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 yes, 1010 Winds, New York.
You know, and they still have the teletype machines in the background. That's the sound of New York. Gritty, you know, 60s era New York. It's very nostalgic.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Kenneth Goldsmith, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Teaches writing at the University of Pennsylvania, senior editor of the online poetry archive. It's called Penn Sound. And this year was named the first poet laureate of MoMA and founding editor of Ubu Web. And we've been talking about some of the ideas in his new book. And it's called Seven American Deaths and Disasters. It's transcriptions and collages of momentous events here in the U.S. And again, if any questions or comments you might have, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to have you read actually a section from your book, and this has to do with the attack on the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. You are a New Yorker, and as I understand it, you were on the street that day watching what was happening to the World Trade Center towers and listening or hearing someone parked in a car listening to their AM radio, I guess, describing what it was that you were watching.
Yeah, it was real. It was real simulacra, as they say. It was hyper-reality. You know, I'm not allowed to ever experience anything unmediated by media. You know, there's always media.
You couldn't have this to yourself, you mean?
No, I couldn't experience it myself. It had to be narrated to me, you know, as I'm watching the buildings fall on Bleecker and 6th Avenue. and I'm listening to a car that had its speakers wide open and a huge crowd, and the whole thing is being narrated to me as if it was, you know, a film. Mm-hmm. Really, mm-hmm. It was displaced from reality. It was.
But
it was
did
remarkable.
You not feel that event? I mean, did that take you out of the experience? That terrible, terrible day.
No, I mean, you know, in a weird way, the sound of media was comforting.
Right.
I was glad it was there. I'm glad. I said, well, you know, at least the radio's still on. This is, you know, things can't be that bad.
Can you read a little section from your book there? And this is, again, some transcriptions from a broadcast that day.
Now, you just wanted me to read the last page.
Yeah, let's do the last page, because that's
sure.
Unusual, I would say.
Sure, sure. And just below me is a park right near the edge of Chinatown. And while there's some curiosity amongst these people, they continue to play their card games. They continue to chat as if nothing is going on. Their markets are open. They're shopping. They're buying their fish. It's as if this little corner of New York City was totally unaffected, but you know it's at the top of their minds. They're talking about it. They're pointing up in the air periodically, and they're continuing with their card games. So it's just a little snapshot of a piece of New York as they deal with this immense tragedy.
And that was a broadcast, and who was speaking that? Do you know?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, some NPR reporter probably. But I love that they, you know, the other, calling the Chinese. You know, it's all about the, you know, the sort of suspect. You know, they're not really into this. You know, they're going about their things. They're shopping. We're all paralyzed with fear, but they're not fake. You know, there's all sorts of innuendo in this little paragraph.
But it is very visual. I mean, one can, it's like a tableau, especially in contrast to we know what is happening all over New York, which you also include in this chapter on the World Trade Center.
Yeah, it's some color reportage, but it is very poetic, but it's also real suspicious of the other. And that's the kind of thing it's in the language. We just don't tend to analyze it and objectify it. It's there, though.
I want to have you read a piece where you talk about being a boring writer, and quoting you here, perhaps being a dumb writer, perhaps one of the dumbest that's ever lived. And first of all, I think dumb is a great word. People don't use it very much. What do you mean by dumb?
What do I mean by dumb? Well, I make a distinction between smart dumb,
yes,
and dumb dumb. And so I can actually talk about it. Maybe I'll just read smart dumb and the dumb dumb. And now, again, you know, this is, you know, it's Steinian. There's something Gertrude Steinian about, you know, this, and I actually say that Stein is an example of smart dumb. But here we are. There is dumb dumb and there is smart dumb. There is also smart smart. Dumb dumb is plain dumb, and smart smart is plain smart. Smart dumb rejects both smart smart and dumb dumb, choosing instead to walk a tightrope between the two. Smart dumb is incisive and precise. In order to be smart dumb, you have to be really smart, but not in the smart smart way. Dumb dumb is rednecks and racists, football hooligans, gum-snapping marketing girls, and thick-necked office boys. Dumb dumb is Microsoft, Disney, and Spielberg. Smart smart is TED Talks, think tanks, NPR News, Ivy League universities, The New Yorker, and expensive five-star restaurants. By trying so hard, smart smart really misses the point. Smart dumb is the Fugs, punk rock, art schools, Gertrude Stein, Vito Acconci, Marcel Duchamp, Samuel Beckett, Seth Price, Tao Lin, Martin Margiela, Mike Kelly, and Sofia Coppola. Smart dumb plays at being dumb dumb, but knows better.
I really like that. I don't totally understand it, but I really like it.
You know, Sofia Coppola is a great example of smart dumb. You know, the Bling Ring is really, in anybody else's hands, would have really been stupid.
Mm.
You know, MTV could have done that and it would have been dumb. But she was so smart about these stupid kids that it held a lot of tension by just sort of letting the characters hang themselves with minimal interference and editorial direction from her. And that's that lovely ambiguity that makes it extremely smart, taking on something culturally way beneath you and elevating it to an art form. It's hard to do.
You've referenced Gertrude Stein several times. Is she an inspiration for you?
Sure.
Someone that you return to?
Everybody loves Gertrude Stein.
Oh, do they?
I think so. I mean, all my friends do, at least. You know.
Is
Stein,
that smart or smart dumb? Or?
She is. Gertrude Stein,
I think she's
is smart dumb. She's very smart dumb. You know, she writes in a limited vocabulary, and she gets into these trances, and everything is repetitious. Mm-hmm. She writes with a third grader's vocabulary, and yet does something incredibly complex with the most simple of means, which makes it extremely, it's not a third grader's writing at all, yet she's using a third grader's means to create very complex literature.
We have been marking the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. We did a show about it earlier this week, and the guests were talking about the simplicity of Lincoln's language, that he used, you know, most of the words in the Gettysburg Address are a single syllable.
Mm.
And then that's sort of part of its power over the years is just the simplicity of the language, the complexity of the ideas.
But I think we're getting, you know, at that more and more with reduced forms. Twitter is making us much simpler. We're getting smart. We have to be smart dumb or dumb smart in Twitter. We've got 140 characters to express ourselves. And I find that that is affecting the way, say, that I write.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting back to something that's, you know, iconic, language that is really iconic.
And, I mean, do you think of what you do as sort of part of what the internet has been doing or is doing, which is cutting and pasting and collaging and transcribing?
Yeah, well, the internet, you know, came along and changed everything, including writing. Now, most writing proceeds as if the internet had never happened. Pick up any book, even literary fiction. I was going to say sort of a, you know, airport bestseller, but literary fiction rarely, you know, picks up those ideas of unoriginality, appropriation. Of course, we have all these literary scandals of plagiarism. Didn't we just have someone in Washington who was caught lifting
Rand
from
Paul.
Wikipedia? Now, this is just, you know, any young writer with a head on their shoulders would be like, well, but, you know, we lift quotes from Wikipedia and drop them into the middle of what we do all the time. That's simply a technique. In my class, which I teach kids how to do this, you know, it's what you choose, you know. It's what you choose to reframe that makes it a better piece of theft.
Ooh, let me pick up on that after this very short break. Kenneth Goldsmith, our guest today on Radio Times, teaches plagiarism, apparently, at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll come right back to our conversation. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
What is the Pulse? Stories at the heart of health science and innovation. WHYY-FM's newest original program launches Friday morning, December 6th at 9. The critical issues and innovations as told by patients, doctors, researchers, and everyday people. Plus, an active and growing online multimedia destination at whyy.org/thepulse. The Pulse launches Friday morning, December 6th at 9 on WHYY-FM.
On the next Fresh Air, should a pregnant woman be legally punished for behavior deemed to endanger the fetus, as some states are doing? We talk with Lynn Paltrow of National Advocates for Pregnant Women, Jennifer Mason of Personhood USA, which supports giving constitutional rights to the fetus, and Barbara Levy of the American College of OBGYNs. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
When you've got it coming.
An earthquake! A
hurricane.
The American people have done everything they possibly can. Now it's time for an act of God, and we're getting it.
Michelle Bachmann's morality aside, what constitutes an act of God in an era where the impact of humans is easier to see than ever? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Kenneth Goldsmith, and again taking calls at 1-888-477-9499, especially if you want to call in about Gertrude Stein. We were just joking about that during the break.
I know, we've got the world talking about Gertrude Stein. I can see they're dying to discuss
Indeed.
That.
Indeed. I'm dying to ask you, though, about this class that you teach at Penn. It's called Uncreative Writing.
Yeah.
And you do have students do things like retype a phone book or retype a menu. And as I understand it, you know, they're sort of quote unquote not allowed to be what, original and creative?
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what that classroom like that would look like or sound like.
Well, you know, the thing about students today is that they plagiarize and they patch write constantly. You know, they're actually very good at it, but they're actually not very good about it because they're not theorizing it. They're trying to get away with something. I say, no, actually, now you have to use these methods here in the classroom, and you've got to be accountable for what you're doing. Now what do you do?
Mm.
You mean I have to think about this? You know, we're going to critique the decision I made, the way in which I mashed two pieces of pre-existing writing of someone else's words together, and it becomes a whole different game. It actually becomes a evaluative of their skill set. And like a DJ, nobody ever says to a DJ, but you know, you didn't play drums on that track. The best DJ has the best samples on their laptop and mixes them in the best way.
Mm.
And this is a model for writing today. Let's admit that the internet is cuttable and pastable. And now what do you do?
And I mean, the original idea of the internet is that it all belongs to all of us.
I think so. And, you know, listen, they could have made the internet where you couldn't have copied and pasted all the text on it. But you can.
Mm.
And that is, the cat is out of the bag now. And so, you know, what do we do? How does writing proceed now that you don't have to write anymore in the traditional way? Now that you can adopt other people's opinions and thoughts as your own.
But you can do that. And it is possible to recreate something out of bits and pieces of someone else's work. But it is their work, isn't it?
It is and it isn't. I mean, if you don't want it copied, don't put it on the internet. You know, handwrite it on a letter. Believe me, nobody will copy it. It's great for terrorists. And, you know, but if you put something out on the web, anything, a cultural artifact, a piece of writing, expect it to be taken not only by humans, but even more so by machines
are
harvesting this stuff like mad.
Like the NSA, you mean?
Well, the NSA, I mean, you know, it's, if it's out there and it's copyable, it's going to be copied. So we have to really adjust our notions of what is ours and what is shared.
So you're willing to give all this, of course, what you have here are other people's words anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I run the website UbuWeb, which is the largest website dedicated to the avant-garde at ubu.com.
Yeah, I checked it out.
And everything is downloadable. I'm just giving away, you know, just giving away everything. Not that many people really want that stuff. It's easy to give away.
It's a niche market
rotten
that you
vegetables,
have here.
You know. Take these rotten tomatoes.
Is Ubu Web like Ubu Wa?
Yeah, yeah. It comes from Alfred Jarry.
Yes.
Yeah. Pataphysics.
You had a radio show for what, 15 years?
I did.
Wow. What was it called? Or did
it was called many things. Many things that I can't say on NPR.
Okay.
But one, you know, it began as Unpopular Music, but then I got bored playing music, and the whole thing became sort of a performance. Every week I come into the studio, I had 3 hours to kill. Now what do I do? I used to sing.
No plan?
No plan. I never plan. I used to sing. I used to do karaoke to Critical Theory. I would sing Derrida over the Allman Brothers. for 3 hours.
And
believe
me, what were your ratings like?
Oh, we couldn't care less. I mean, it was, you know, we never looked at ratings. We were instructed, you know, on WFMU, which was the station manager, Ken Friedman, always says, there are going to be times, dear listeners, when you will have to turn the radio off.
Right.
Yeah.
And you did broadcast, as I understand, you know, hours of dead air or silence.
Sure. Why not?
With an occasional, what, station ID?
Well, you have to do a top of the hour station
you
ID.
Do,
that's
yes.
right. That's right. Yeah. I also, one of my, you know, I had a recording of two men sleeping. I played that. They were snoring for 3 hours.
You are very Andy Warhol.
Well, I am. I mean, of course. You know, we're all very Andy Warhol. And Warhol was so out there in front of everything that's going on. And the reason that we're so interested in Warhol is because, for better or worse, the world turned out to be exactly as he predicted.
Mm.
For better or worse. You know, I'm not saying that it's the ideal condition, but it is the condition, you know, in which we're living.
Andy Warhol said, art is what I can get away with.
I mean, we don't know if that was Warhol, but a lot of people say that, you know, good artists steal, you know, all of that kind of thing. And it's all true. Art is a utopian field. You know, I always say in my practice, I say a few things. I say, if I raised my kids the way I wrote my books, I would have been thrown in jail a long time ago.
Mm.
You know, I'm a rather radical, plagiaristic writer. I'm a rather conservative, traditional parent.
That's interesting.
You know, I also say that, you know, art is pretty harmless stuff to try out some unpopular attitudes. I say, you know, no animals were harmed in the making of this book. It's art, really. You know, it's the collateral damage is slight, if at all.
You're described as a poet. Does that, I mean, do you write poems?
I don't know how to write a poem. I don't even know the rules of a sonnet. Because poetry is just so, who cares?
Mm.
It's open now for reinterpretation. It's you know, kind of nobody wants that label. You know, who wants to be a poet? You know, nobody wants to be a poet.
Mm.
And so it's a sort of empty space. You know, the stuff that I'm doing in poetry has been done for years in visual art, been done for years in music, but it's never been done in writing before.
You're also interested, and I do want to play actually another clip that goes back to your book, but I mean, you are interested in sound, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, yeah. I love cadence. You know, I mean, the voice can hydrate the driest of texts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why kids love books being read to them, the same stupid book over and over again, read to them at night, because the voice is just can animate. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can actually read the phone book in a radio voice. I know you have a great voice. If you read the phone book for an hour tomorrow on the show, I bet it would be beautiful.
Really?
I dare you to do that.
That's your radio show. We do have a caller. It looks like Lee. Lee joining us from Kensington. Lee, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. We're back in the dark ages here on Radio Times. Go ahead, Lee. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I have a question for Kenneth. I'm actually a big fan, so before I ask my question, I want to ask that I've read Uncreative Writing, and I've listened to the WFMU program for a long time before
it
went
off
the air. I'm a curator for a living, and I curate contemporary art. My question is for Kenneth about how he thinks about his audience. Is it enough for him to think about the concept of his pieces and judge them a success just there? Does he read them? Does he try them out, with the public? How do you decide, Kenneth, what is a successful piece? And how do you think about your audience's reaction to them?
Lee, thanks for
before presenting them.
Sure. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you think about that?
Well, I know they're good. You know, I spend years on these things, and I realize that if the concept is good, and the concept behind a book, the machine, is well constructed, any language I pour into that machine is going to be a successful result. I actually like to write literature without failure.
Without failure?
Without the possibility of failure.
So you're good. I mean, you know you're good.
I know my ideas that I put out in the world are good, and the ones that I put out are always successful, believe me, there's a lot that don't make it out into the world.
So, I mean, if you think it's good, do you care if someone thinks it isn't?
Well, I figure if I find it interesting, there's going to be somebody else that, out there that finds it interesting. And it's true. There are. Even mainstream places like the New York Times or the Colbert Report or the White House actually finds my odd obsessions to be relevant and interesting.
And I have to say to our listeners, I saw him on the Colbert Report, and saw that he taught at Penn, and that's how Kenneth Goldsmith ended up on Radio Times. Let me get, looks like Matthew from Kensington to join us. And Matthew, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
You stated that you think that the Panic Live description of a murder was beautiful, so I was just wondering if you ever listen to 911 tapes and transcribe those and find those beautiful.
Well, I think that's a great question. As a matter of fact, there's one chapter in my book that is a 911 transcription, and that is a woman trapped in the library at Columbine High. Mm. And that's the only real live transcription. It's a horrific thing that's out there on it's out there on the web. I took it. I massaged it a little bit. Where do you end with this? You could go on and on. And these are only seven tragedies, and since I finished this book, there have been seven more tragedies of equal magnitude. You know, we had the movie shooting in Colorado, every day.
Shooting.
I mean, this book could go on for the rest of my life, unfortunately.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. I do want to play another clip, and this is an excerpt of ABC's Monday Night Football broadcast. It's at the end of the Patriots-Dolphins game featuring the late Howard Cosell with Frank Gifford. And here they are handling the news of John Lennon being shot. This is December 8th, 1980. Let's listen.
Remaining, John Smith is on the line, and I don't care what's on the line, Howard. You have got to say what we know in the booth.
Yes, we have to say it. Remember, this is just a football game, no matter who wins or loses. An unspeakable tragedy confirmed to us by ABC News in New York City. John Lennon, outside of his apartment building on the west side of New York City, the most famous perhaps of all of the Beatles, shot twice in the back, rushed to Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival. To go back to the game after that news flash, which in duty bound we had to take. Frank?
Indeed it is.
And he says they're hard to go back to the football game after that news.
Yeah, the Lennon assassination comes from a tape that's been floating around the web. Some guy was just doing a radio scan on the night John Lennon died. Mm. And he had the tape recorder there, and he kept flipping through the radio. And every station he'd hit on the FM dial would be talking about Lennon. And so it's a prefabricated collage piece. It's very beautiful. Mm-hmm. Again, repetitious, and everybody's sort of getting it wrong and trying to figure out what's going on, and a lot of emotion that night.
Sure, and just hearing even Howard Cosell's famous voice, you know, this sort of a reminder, this is just a football game. And again, sort of toggling between this piece of entertainment and, of course, then the death of John Lennon.
Which soon becomes entertainment, you know. I mean, it's layers upon layers and mirrors upon mirrors and, you know, reflections and refractions. And, you know, this is our media landscape. It's all Warholian. Again, you have to just go back to Warhol to understand our world.
Mm. You're working on something now. It sounds like a very big project. And again, I don't quite understand it. Called Capital?
Mm.
What is that?
Oh, my. Well, I mean, I think the best book that has ever been written was written by Walter Benjamin, and it was an unfinished book. It was called The Arcades Project. And what Benjamin did was for 20 years, he just sat in libraries and read books about Paris, and with a highlighter, you know, proverbial highlighter, highlighted the very best parts of those books.
Wow.
Just a couple of paragraphs here and there, and then threw them into these folders. He just wrote them out in longhand, things about Paris in the 19th century, about prostitution, about advertising, about the boulevards, about housemen, et cetera, et cetera. And by the time it was all done, he had just had over half a million words about a collage history of Paris in the 19th century. I'm using his identical methodology to treat New York in the 20th century.
Wow.
So I'm just reading every book ever written about or during the 20th century and taking out the coolest parts and throwing them into folders and going to publish the whole thing as a 1,000-page book.
Oh, we love 1,000-page books on Radio Times.
I'm sure it's going to be a bestseller.
I'm curious about something you wrote, and this goes back, I guess, a number of years, only because I've done Bloomsday readings. Fidget, about your various body movements over this 13-hour period. Sometimes I guess it feels like a 13-hour period. This was a Bloomsday in 1997. Were you actually at a reading?
No, I locked myself in my apartment. I kicked my wife out, and I woke up, and I described every move my body made. Took me an hour and a half just to get out of bed.
Oh, just because I am moving, right?
Well, I never used the word I. I said finger move slightly counterclockwise to the left. You know, elbow thrusts out.
Sort of like Ulysses, right? His daily... You know, this is a day in the life of...
Or Beckett. You know, Beckett, you'd have the bum on his back struggling to get over to his stomach. But Beckett, it was all a metaphor for the struggle of humanity. Mine has none of that. Mine is simply observing one's own bodily motions and recording that.
Well, on that note, Kenneth Goldsmith, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
This has been great. Thank you.
You're very welcome. The book is called Seven American Deaths and Disasters, and he teaches writing at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the first poet laureate of MoMA. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. In fact, for more information about the show and to continue the conversation, you can go to our Facebook page, again, at whyy.org/Radio Times. And you can follow us on Twitter at WHYY Radio Times and at Marty Moss Cohen. Jessica Crocker, the intern for today's edition of the show. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant, and Sophie Reed today. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.